From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Chad Beater.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
And we have your plus one here today.
His plus one, either way you look at it.
Yeah, so what are we going to talk about today on the show?
We're just going to go through boring debugger commands. We've done a lot of things about, you know, capturing dumps and opening it up when there's an exception or a crash. Chad went through going through a bug check, equivalent for for kernel mode versus user mode. But there's a whole lot of commands you just need to know to just navigate around. A lot of these commands are more about when you take a dump of a process at some point in time and you want to work out what's happening. So is there CPU issues, if there's memory issues, stuff like that. So a lot of the commands, you know, some of them are boring, some of them are interesting, and we're just going to try to give our, you know, opinion on why you would use them, when we use them personally, and go from there.
Awesome. Sounds exciting. I'm glad that I got a good night's sleep.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, this will give you a nice sleep when you can watch it again later. So.
Awesome. Well, let's get started.
Yeah, so we're just going to bring up a live debug of Notepad, which is our favorite, what do you want to call it, example program.
The classic.
It is. And it'll be at the end of the list. And so we're attached to Notepad. And I'm just going to do a CLS first, which is clear screen. And a lot of things we do in support is about analyzing things and then giving that information to someone else, right? And so there's a lot of tools that we need to do that say where we're up to and what the hell we're working on. And you know, we're just understanding what's happening in the analysis phase so far. And you know, you probably agree that if someone doesn't write good case notes, it's like studying it again, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you definitely have to make sure that you document everything you do in our line of work.
Yeah, and a lot of things about the debugger, because it's text, it's great. So when you have these old antiquated case systems that only take text, well, the debugger is a really good tool to translate from that to the system. You don't have to worry about screenshots and that type of junk. So one of the very first commands that people are taught, which you don't really use very often, is just straight version. People go, what debugger are you using and stuff like that? And it just dumps out a whole lot of information about, you know, the environment that you're debugging in. So you need to know what tool you're using so that the analysis makes sense. And you know, if there's some quirks with the debugger in older versions, you go, well, you had version 6.3. We know there's a quirk, so I wouldn't trust this line of code, that type of stuff. So what this command does is just dumps out a lot of environmental issues about the debugger itself. So the first one is information about the operating system, and I'll get back to that in a sec. Here's the key debugger command. Command line that's being used, the versions of the main DLLs that do the main thinking for the debugger, and then the information about the debugger extensions. So this is kind of wordy, and you don't really need all this information, and all these actually can be broken down into individual commands. And so what you tend to do is the very first one that a lot of people do is ver target. What do you particularly look for in this when you...
Well, you're going to want to know what version and service pack the OS is on when you get a, you know, the first thing when you get a memory dump or something, you want to see what they're running. Mm. So that you can kind of, you know, a lot of times we'll get issues where, you know, there may be a known bug in a particular OS or something like that, and we need to know, you know, what they're running.
And particularly, we get a lot of cases where they're on RTM and they haven't got Service Pack 1 yet.
Yeah.
And you go, why are we seeing this? And you go, yeah, I know this is fixed. And you go back in, you haven't got Service Pack 1 installed because it'll be missing up here. There'll be a little text up top here saying Service Pack 1.
Yeah, the other thing that's really good about this is it shows you the system uptime.
Yeah, this one. So, you have to be kind of careful with system uptime because there's some commands that tell you how much CPU happened, and we'll go through those later, but the system uptime may be up for 24 hours, and this program may have only used 1 minute of CPU power, but was it a couple of milliseconds over the last few days, or was it all in the last few seconds, right?
Yeah.
And so you've got to remember this is a point-in-time snapshot, and you can't make assumptions that the system was up for 16 days and the process was up for 2 days, but you can't assume that this process power was
recent,
yeah. Kernel time and user time are kind of interesting, and in Task Manager, there's been a, in the graph, you can always say show kernel times. You know how it adds that red line?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what this is showing. It's, that red line is the kernel time and below it, and the user time is from the red line up to the green. And so user time roughly is what a developer has coded, right? And then the kernel time is what the Microsoft has given to you as infrastructure. And if you see a lot of kernel time, that suggests that you are, you know, pushing the operating system to the max. You're asking for a huge amount of like file I/O or something like that. You may be doing a lot of AV scanning, which is down in the kernel. You may be doing a lot of video decoding, which is down in the kernel. And so you can kind of get an idea of who's proportionally using the CPU power and whether you're being a bit heavy on your user code or you're being pushing the kernel really hard. And it's good to know a split. There's a lot of things that if you get an infinite loop type in your code, well, that will show up as users time. And so you know that, hey, this is running really hot. And you'll see these numbers just fly through the roof. And what you'll get is if you have a program that's been running quite recently and it has a user time that's very close to the process uptime, that's bad because it's showing that you've got 100% CPU saturation. And no program really should have the justification to do that. I mean, I suppose there's a few exceptions.
You're doing video encoding or something, yeah, like that, maybe. But
so with Windows 8, does system uptime persist after you shut down, given that it's not really a shutdown with Windows 8, it's a hybrid?
I believe it'll still reset that back to zero on a regular, well, actually on a full reboot. If you actually, on Windows 8, select restart, that does do a full restart. But even I think just on the shutdown case and then powering it back up, we would still reset the system uptime.
Yeah, I just did a restart to boot this box. Yeah, I'm not sure whether we can trust this to tell you or not.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a good question. Version numbers, if you get to
them.
Yeah, you did, all right.
It's Windows 8, it's new, man.
This particular number in the middle is what you kind of get used to. In Windows 7, you'll see 8700.
Windows 7 would be 7601?
Yeah, so 7600.
7600, 7601.
And the 1 is Service Pack 1, so that one-digit change. So even though this is roughly the days, we build Windows every day, and a number that goes up every day, so roughly it's been 9,200 days since we started building Windows daily. We actually skip forward to a nice round number for each release, so we're skipping a couple hundred numbers, but within about 1,000, that's how many days Windows has been compiled. But when we compile the service pack, it only gets up by 1. And then you'll see the next version of Windows jump forward by a couple of thousand because it takes like 1,000 days to develop Windows, right? Once we've said before, this actually kind of scrolls on the screen when you start Windows, the debugger. You can find out the target. So x64 is obviously a 64-bit app on 64-bit Windows. You'll see x86 and ARM these days. Free is the kernel. There's two versions of the kernel. Think of free as the release build and think of the, what's the other one called, checked build as the debug build. It's not really a debug build in the way that you think it in the user mode point of view. It just does a couple more, it doesn't do anything extra. It just puts more checks on things. So it doesn't slow you down too much. And check builds is a great way. If the system's kind of unstable, you replace particularly the kernels, NTOS kernel and how.dll with a check version, and then that makes sure that the fundamental things like the memory and the scheduling are a bit more stable and move forward. So the avert target I use, all of us use quite regularly.
You'll notice it says Windows 7 there, even though this is a Windows 8.
Yeah, I think that's an artifact of the debugger. Yeah, this is. I'm still using the Windows 7 debugger, even though it's a Windows 8 build. It gets it here, though, and you can see where I use an internal.
Yeah.
This is the MSDN ISO, so you can see the internal name for the ISO, that particular build for the ISO. The other two you use, and this is the pipe command, the one that's on the backslash key. The pipe command gives you the target. And so sometimes this will come back blank if you're live debugging like a kernel and stuff. But with a user mode process, you'll get the name of the process. And the other one is double pipe, which is how you got there. If you open up a dump file, I think I've got one right here, I'll show you. You'll get the name of the file. And that's one of the... I personally make sure that every single time I do case notes, that's in there, so people have a clue about where this data came from. And also, if I get a particularly a memory.dump file, they always call memory.dump. And the first thing I do when I receive it is I rename it and I put on the date from the debug session time on the file, because otherwise there's nothing really unique to remember where it came from.
Later you're like, where was that dump file? I have 40 files here called memory.dump.
Yeah. Those two are kind of nice to have and polite for other users, and things you should just get used to doing. There's two more that are very polite for other people. There's the SIMPath. So we've been, since episode one, we showed how having their environment variables kicks in, and so these this has been sucked in by the debugger and put here. But if you had to change the symbol path to make things resolve, so say you got a private build or something, and you had to add like a UNC path to the end to make it work, well, it's polite to, once you've got your symbols configured and working, print out the symbol path so the next person knows where to get those files. Equally to that, source path is where the source code came from, so those two kind of go hand in hand. There's two other ones which are in this family of the dot something path. There's also XCPath. And so we talked about in one of the episodes way ago that the command lmvm will show you something about a module, and sometimes there'll be a line that says mapped image file. And if the dump file, that particularly the dump file is a mini dump, so not a full dump, which doesn't have all the memory, the executable is not in that file and has to be sucked in from somewhere. And so the XCPath, you can set it to say, hey, these files are actually on this foreign server. If it's blank, it actually defaults to the SIMPath. But if someone has set it deliberately, be nice and put it in there. The other one that's kind of not as necessary in your case notes, but just good to have, is your extension path. The extension path defaults to, based on the target, the debugger will put a whole lot of debugger-based extension on here, so you can see that this is WinXP and above extensions, extensions for everybody, and then we go on and on and on. And then finally, you get your path variable. If you are using extensions, say, from a network share or something, once again, you can add that there and be polite to the next person so they know when you see bang quidjibo.fantastic, where you got the quidjibo extension from. And then the kind of associated with extension is .chain, which we've talked about before, which just shows you what extensions are loaded explicitly. So you'll see, their comment, the path on here and where they got them from. Is there any particular extensions that you think are the most... what's your opinion on extensions versus the inbuilt commands? Do you think you can debug without extensions these days, or has it got so hard that you really can't?
It depends what you're debugging, but certainly for certain classes of issues, the extensions are kind of indispensable.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're looking at shell issues, for example, you need to see what windows are on the screen, and things like that.
Yeah. I think the problem with the programs is they're getting so complex, right? And yes, you could do it the hard way and, get a pointer and follow that pointer and blah, 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 and do that 4 million times and 2 years later get to the answer. But the extensions just brute force it. And there's a lot of extensions that really do use brute force. They have no knowledge of really what the context is, and they just try to use heuristics and just blast through the dump file trying to find evidence. And I think they're indispensable now. So, and that's why actually all the rest of this list is. The whole rest of this list I'm about to give you is just extensions now. And it's just going to give us a holistic view of what happens in the process. If you have a crash dump, and what's the number one command you run when you have a crash dump? Anybody?
Bang analyze.
So there's bang analyze actually works for user and kernel dumps. It's kind of weird that you'll find that at tech ed and conferences like that, we'll only tend to talk about bang analyze in the context of bug checks and kernel dumps, but they actually work on user dumps too. Now this is going to say I just broke into the debugger, which is all I did. So if I analyze this guy, so analyze gives you just a brief rundown of what the deal is, and then V is verbose, and it will give you its full analysis of it. And you can see here, status breakpoint is the reason I broke in. Well, that's what I did. I injected a breakpoint to the process when I attached to it, and the breakpoint fired, and that caused an exception, and the debugger went, oh, that's an exception, and it stopped it. And we actually look at the stack right now. Actually, which one it will be. Whoops. No, it's not there yet, but you can actually see it in certain scenarios. The other one that you can do, and it's not going to work in user mode, but I'll show you, is Bang Analyzer at the top has, it's not going to show it, I think, because it's the user mode, but you'll have the bug check code, and we talked about that, you talked about that last week and the week before. You can get the same information by doing it. It's not going to work because it's not a kernel dump, but it will just give you that straight numbers. So if you just need to know the number and know the spew, dot bug check. The other one that's kind of associated with all these things and is just, you know, error codes. If you get an error code, and we talked about this before, we might do 1, 2, 3.
The classic.
Access violation. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of weird. Once you start learning the numbers, don't you?
There's a few of them you learn by heart after a while.
Yeah. Bang error is just a great way of looking up an error code.
Use that all the time.
Yeah. You can do it for the website, and we have that on one of my links many, many episodes ago. But, it's just way easier in the debugger. So, all right, so let's talk about some user mode-centric things. Let's talk about the threads of a process. We haven't, at the moment, gone through that. Chad did it last week for the kernel, but I still haven't done it for user mode. So a process has threads. Now, at the moment, because I broke in quite early in the Notepad, it hasn't really done anything. I haven't got that many threads. So I'm going to do G for go, which is, this is a dump file.
That's your dump.
That's not going to work.
You can't run a dump.
So there's only going to be one thread in here. I guess that's why I couldn't find the break-in thread. And there's the breakpoint. So this is the code that got injected, and this guy made a breakpoint. That's why we got our analyze. Let's do a go on this guy. And I know that if I open up the file dialog in Notepad, we get some activity. And you can see as we did that, all these modules loaded. So this is all as the code needed, it went, I need to know, have this DLL loaded. And you can see the load points. And you can see some of the exceptions. So if we were using procdump to monitor this, this is the same thing that you would see in the procdump screen, so kind of an equivalent interface. So you can see a lot of DLLs got loaded, and a lot of those guys believe that they need to have threads for various reasons, particularly they want to run up a thread to keep these views up to date, so if someone on the network changes the file or something. And so if we break into this guy now, and do the tilde command. So that's the command.
To the left of the one.
But what's the other command called?
Backquote.
The tilde command will give you all of the threads. And so the number down here at the bottom, the 000 number, is the number on here on the left. Right. BF0, that is the process ID, the PID of the target. And then this number is the thread ID. Debugger is all hexadecimal. And as you can see, the dot is our current context, that's the word for it. And then hash is the reason why we stopped. Right, so you can kind of move around and see other people. There's a couple of ways of changing between threads. You can just use the number. So let's say we want to see what number 10's doing, right? So for thread number 10, you can do commands, and there's two commands you can do in user mode. You can say, I want to view the stack, so we've used the K command previously for that, and so this will print me out the stack, but we'll still be in the context of zero. See how the zero down at the bottom didn't change, and we've still got the dot up here. Instead of just showing the stack of the other command, we can set it as our new context. The same kind of thing exists in kernel. The difference is the S and the K commands don't exist. So in the kernel, instead of changing between threads of a process, you are changing between physical cores. And there may or may not be a thread running on that core. Well, there will be a thread running, but it might be the idle one kicking it asleep. So the S and the K don't apply in the kernel space, so when you're changing between cores. So that, for example, this would change to core number 10, which would be the 11th core. So because we've set context, and now we do the K, we've moved across, right? When you have an exception, the exception happens on a particular thread, right, the one with the hash. And when the debugger comes up with that exception context record, the .ecxr, it should be on that thread. If you navigate away from that thread and go like, I'm going to change to number 3, and then do ecxr, you're still looking at 3, even though the context on the frames on the other one have moved up and down. So be aware that you need to still be responsible for being on the right thread. The debugger, as I said, does default you to the right thread. So this, so you can move around threads, right? So you can see what every single stack's doing. And it kind of gets laborious if you want to, you know, go
every single one.
Particularly when you look at exchange process, which has like 1,500 threads. So there's some aggregative commands. So instead of using a number, you use star, which says applies to all threads. And so what you can do is say, show me the stack of all threads. All right. The other one you can do is show me the registers of all threads. It's kind of hard. The register one's kind of annoying because it doesn't actually tell you what thread you're up to. So that's one of them, and there's the next one. So you don't really know what thread it is, so there's kind of a limiting there. Have I preferred DML on? Turn it on just in case. As I said in a couple of episodes ago, turn preferred DML on, so things like the K command now give you nice output. When I sometimes you know the issue because of, you know, tracing and event log and stuff like that of what thread went bad, and sometimes that will give you the thread ID rather than this arbitrary number on the front. The ordering in DBG doesn't really have any, I don't know, rhyme to reason to it. It can be whatever order it wants. It doesn't even have to be zero based in certain scenarios. So if you need to change to a thread and its number is a bit dubious, what you can do is if instead of doing tilde then say 3set, you get rid of that, you do double tilde, and that puts it into thread ID mode rather than in DBG's numbering mode. You then use square brackets and then you have to put the hexadecimal in there. Okay, it's complex, and then that will move to that thread. Really, really useful if you are, particularly with using proc dump, if you take a sequence of dump files, right? And say it's a high CPU one, and you want to find out what's happening on these samples. So you open up the first dump, and you realize it's thread number 5. Well, in the second dump file, that thread 5 that has, you know, CF0 as its thread ID may be now number 7 or may number 12, right? It may have moved around because of thread creation destruction. But you want the script or the commands that you've worked out that work out the issue to be repeated on every other one. And so you use this tilde tilde command to jump to the right thread and not have to worry about the reordering that DBG imposes on you. Took me like 2 years to learn that. And I did it the hard way for 2 years. And then when I realized, I went, oh, I was like, really? Someone couldn't have told me that at the start?
No one tells you anything.
Yeah.
It's all about
learn on bang, the job.
Banging your head. Until you finally figure it out.
Yeah, I saw a speech internally one day about a year ago, and the guy goes, this guy over here, he just learned about this command. You know what he's going to do? He's going to come to the team meeting and present it. And it's true. I mean, unfortunately, there's so many esoteric commands, and it is quite a large command base, and it's just hard to know what people do and don't know, and you can't sit down and teach someone every single command. A, they'll forget it, and B, you haven't got enough time for it. And it is a bit of self-discovery. I mean, I don't know about you, but I love the help file. I think the help file is one of the best help files that Microsoft's ever produced.
Yeah, yeah. You learn something new every time you look at it.
Yeah. And that's the thing about case notes, right? If you have clear, concise case notes and the next person reads and they go, oh, I didn't know about that command. I didn't know about that extension. Yeah. I mean, I've learned at least half of my knowledge from other people's case notes.
On the shoulder of giants.
That's right. Have you learned anything from customers' case notes?
Some of ours, because we have really...
pretty sophisticated.
We're both the OEM team, yeah. Our customers are great. They really are deep and technical, and we learn things from them. Yeah. They go, you know, the Quidgibo's broken. It's like, okay.
What's that?
What's Quidgibo? It's part of Windows? Yeah, it's been there for 5 years. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah.
And I'm meant to be the main expert in it? Okay. So if you're in the kernel, the equivalent command to see all of the threads of every single thing, or every single process, is bang 0 and then 17. A lot of the debugger extensions use bit masks to populate their output. The 0 on bang process says everybody. If you did -1, it would mean current process, so you don't have to go work out what this big 64-bit number is and paste it in there. And then the second number is the mask. You know, one is the basic output. Seven turns on a whole lot of bits, and particularly the top one bit, that 10OX10 bit, that turns on symbol resolution for user mode stacks. Once again, nobody told me this for years, and I did it the hard way, but if you want to see every single stack from top to bottom, or bottom to top, whichever way you want to look at it, 17 is the magic number. Mm-hmm. So that's the equivalent of tilde star K in the user space. There's also Bang Thread, not to be confused with Bang Threads. And I don't use this too often, but Bang Threads does equivalent of like a tilde star idea across all the threads. And what this is going to do is break apart all of the stacks and give us... Where's my mouse gone? Give us information that's kind of generic for threads, and particularly the thread ID, as you can see here on the front, this one here, and then the PEB, we'll get to the PEB in a stack in a sec. The PEB has this information that follow it, so it has the stack bait and the stack limit. So a stack is the thread's memory range, and it gives you roughly where the functions start and where possibly they could grow to. So within this range, if you scan that memory range, you could find all the local variables, for example, right? And you sometimes use this information to go, okay, for all these ranges, let's scrape it for strings and stuff like that to see if we can find some raw data. And then and, you know, how big is the stack and stuff like that. I think an idea of how big it is. You can see that Notepad's been optimal and not used a very big stack for this one. It knows it's not going to grow very deep, so it's not wasting the extra, I don't know, 500K or something that the other guys are using up. If you're trying to find a stack, so if we look at a K here, let's find anybody who has this guy on the front. It only works from the front. Find stack. So if you know what the function name is up to some point, this will go across all of them, and it will find it. So thread 6, 7, 8, 9, 12, they all had that frame in it. So then you know which of the threads to go look for. So if you're going, which thread's running my function at the moment, I know it's in there somewhere. You know, the function that worries about background updates, this goes search for that symbol that we know about and do that. And the last one is, so that's more of a fine thing to do with stacks. There's a command called unique stack. And what that does is it goes through all of the stacks, and if all the frames look the same, it doesn't bother repeating them. So you see style, is that a good word for it, maybe? Signature?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I'll go with that.
Yeah. So you see all the signatures. So this process at the moment only has... whatever it is, five or six threads that look a certain way, and all these threads are a repeat of something you've seen above, right? So if you have these big behemoths which have a lot of worker threads that are idle, we don't want to see, you know, 100 worker threads over and over again with just a couple of frames of it waiting. And so it's a good way of culling down these big guys down to something a bit more manageable. So as I said, I'd get to the PEB and the TEB. So the a thread has a TEB, which is
thread environment block.
Yeah, and then the process has a PEB, process environment block. I'll start with PEB first. PEB. A PEB is really a description of what the process is. So you'll get information about all the DLLs loaded in the process. As you can see right here, what is it being debugged right now? Yes, it is. You know, just general information about what the process address space is and all that type of stuff. At the bottom, which is the part that is useful, is you will get things like the current directory, right, which is kind of very useful. The Windows title, so you know how you get Notepad at the top, and so. That's interesting. Yeah, blah blah. The link, the name of the image, so you know on the hard drive what started the process, what was the exe that started, what the command line was. So that's very useful. You get some of these dumps and you go, well, what mode was it in? You know, particularly when it comes to some of the system services which have a particular user that it runs as, it will pass it in saying run as local system or something.
If there were switches passed in when that got launched, you'll see them there.
Yeah. The environment blocks. This is a block of RAM inside the process that explains their environment variables. So the process gets the environment variables at the time that it is launched. If you go and change the path in the system after that, it doesn't update this guy. The only way that some of those things would update is if they've actually got a thread that is subscribed to environment variable updates, and they purposely have the code to do that. So if you're wondering why some environment variable isn't applied, well, you know, check the environment table in the process to see if it was there in the first place. You can get with a recent release of Process Monitor, I think it was about half a year ago, the process environment block is also now in the Process Monitor's process start event. So you can use Process Monitor in the same way for that. So a PEB is about the process, and every single thread has an equivalent called the TEB. And the TEB gives you the same information we saw in that bang threads command as a wide thing, the stack base and the stack limit. So that's the bounds of where we're up to. And if we look at the K command, we started down at DFDF0, which is one opcode or one instruction, one function address higher than the base.
Stack frame away.
Yeah, one stack frame away, that's the way of putting it. And then limit is how far we can go. So if you get a stack overflow, it's the distance between those two that defines how far you can go. At the moment, we are nowhere near that. The RSP register and ESP in x86 and BSP in Itanium and PC in ARM.
You got me on that one. I don't know. I can't remember the Itanium one.
Yeah. This is where we're up to. So we're up to 6FB18, and that's, you know, nowhere near this guy. So we've still got a bit of space in this stack to grow. Do you do much stack-based trawling? Like, because what happens, you get some cases where you go up and it did some work and then it came down and it crashed because you did a stack overflow, because variables are defined here and you write them that way. So like if you had a string, it goes like hello world this way, and the world could wipe over previous information. But you don't know what function you were in when it went down.
Right.
So sometimes what you do is you get the limits and you look from where you are now, which is low, and you actually look up to the limit and see what's happened in the stack as you go up and down in history. And you can get an idea of maybe what happened in recent history.
It gets to be a little bit of a detective work, but you can kind of see what slop is on there from functions that may have executed previously.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's an experience thing where you know what to trust and what's, because it's hard to tell if it does this, like what residuals respond, you know, relate to which things.
Occasionally, if you get a dump file where the stack has been corrupted for some reason, and the K command may not give you a good output because it's just too trashed, and then you have to resort to kind of dumping it manually and looking for what's on there to get an idea of what that thread might have been doing.
And in the K command, there's a couple of variants. The easiest way I can describe it is what you do is you get the RSP value. I'm just going to cross my fingers that this works. You go K equals. So equals means don't read it from the current context, which is the registers. I'm going to give it to you. Get the RSP value that you want, which is somewhere on the stack, something that points to a function, and I'll show the command in a sec for that, and just put it twice for x86 and then put a number, like how many frames you're willing to believe, like 99, for example. If it's x86, put it 3 times. All right. This is 64-bit, and there we go. You'll get some rubbish at the start as it goes, oh, it's around here somewhere, oh, I've got it, and then it sinks, and then you'll get the rest. Very useful when you don't have symbols. Like if you don't have absolutely anything, you'll be going down, and then it will just collapse and stop, and what you'll do is you'll look at something below it that's good again, and then rebuild from that point and do the rest. So it's a way of, I don't know, concatenating fragments of information that you may have. And so what you can do for scanning is there's a whole lot of commands. So D is for display, and then we want all the display to be done in pointer size, right? when you put one extra letter on the end, instead of looking at just one point that you're going to give your address, it's going to scan it for a range, right?
Yeah, I think it does a symbol lookup when you do the S.
Right? Oh, well, yeah. So there's, but the DP with something else does this for all of them, and then there's variants of S, U, A, and
A. Oh, right, yeah.
And so this, let's just give an example to see what we can scrape out of this guy. And you can get an idea of, hopefully we should find these three guys again. Oops, sorry, we need to scrape from here. And 95% of the time, I get these back to front because they're order dependent, and we will find out whether today is my lucky day. Yeah, it was my lucky day. You have to go low to high, not high to low. If you go the wrong way around, it goes, that's an invalid range. And so you can see what it did is for every single pointer increment, so this is 64-bit, so it's 8 bytes, it tried to look it up. And so this is... looking at the memory, and it found a function there, and then it's got some weird stuff and lots of zeros, and then down finally it found those other two functions that we're looking at. I doubt we're going to find, so that was looking for symbols, so what it's doing is trying to find every one of those pointers, see if it matches a function name, so it's a symbol lookup. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time to do that if you haven't got your symbols loaded. Remind me to say dot reload in a sec. What we can do is do the same and look for anything that's a Unicode string, and did it work? And I don't think we're going to find. Actually, I think thread 0 may have it, because I think
there's something there that says string.
Yeah, but it's not really a real one. I'm saying hopefully, see, it's trying to just apply it, and that value obviously is good enough to be inside the Unicode, is it code page? Is that the word for it? And so hopefully on this thread, there you go, We found some stuff. So there's how this thing got started, right? And then it allocated what Windows workstation it's going to be on. And a lot of times you'll just get Asian type characters because it just happens to map a lot of good pointers into that range that look like Asian characters. And look, we even found the string for Notepad. So DPS looks for symbols, DPU looks for Unicode strings, DPA looks for ASCII strings, which I don't think we're going to find any because most programs are Unicode. And the other one you can do, which is not usually that useful, is pointers. So it will keep on following the pointer while it's valid. And so it's a way of finding something that's a pointer to a pointer and then to a structure or something. So, as I said, the DPS is really slow if you haven't got symbols loaded. Currently, you can see how all these have the word deferred. So I type the command lm, list modules. And so if you do a dot reload without any switch on it, it will just reload it for the current stack, and this one will be fine, but we'll still find that other stacks don't have it resolved. It's deferred. And so what you can do is force symbol loading. And I highly suggest you do this. It's a great way of speeding up your process. You get into your dump file, do a reload. If it looks like it's going to take a while, go get a coffee. You're going to need it anyway because you're about to do debugging. And everything will be pre-done. I don't know if you've seen it, but I haven't pointed it out, but there's been a lot of symbol loading rubbish intertwined with some of the commands we've been doing, and it's not great for case notes. So reload everything, and now every single command will be always clean. It won't have any interruptions saying, oh, by the way, I have to load this symbol now. And so reload /F. If you're in the kernel and you just change context from, say, one thread to another, /U will reload the user part of the stack. So by default in the kernel, it only resolves the kernel symbols. It doesn't bother worrying about the ones in the user space, and so /use for that.
I didn't know you could do that. I always do /user.
Oh, can you? Maybe it's a shortcut. See,
maybe I learned something today too.
The
you
other
can
one.
Present it.
Yeah. Save yourself 3 characters of typing.
Yeah. So that's about half an hour. Oh, actually, I'll give you one more before we head off for the day. So there's one. There's a couple more things down here. There's a TLS. And there's also this last error stuff. So the command get last error, the Win32 command, is stored in the thread environment block, right? And so that's how that, when you can go into a function and then go get last error, it's just actually pulling out the environment block rather than some location off the stack or something. And so if you want to see what Teb has already showed, which is these two, you can do bang GLE, get last error, and it will print it out for you. So it's kind of like bang error, but you don't have to find what error code was in the stack. Yeah. And actually, you won't find it because it tends to be in the thread environment block and then put into a register. And so you don't tend to find it in the stack. So it's a good way of doing that. The other thing that is quite rare is a thing called thread local storage. Sometimes you need to have a variable that only that thread knows about. So if you have 1,000 threads, you don't want to have a global variable which has, you know, 1,000 array elements in it. Classic example for TLS is things like, this thread has run this many times, and you just want to keep it for performance statistics, right? And so there's an API called thread local storage, and you can get what's called a TLS slot. And so if you do bang TLS, you can see the slots for the current thread. So for example, to see what slots are in the process, so you allocate slots at the process level, and then you put the data in a per thread slot. And so a program will do get TLS slot, and then it will do set TLS value. And so you can see the TLS values. And you'll see this more and more with if you're doing a lot of CLR internals. This is how they do a lot of the tracking and stuff. And so, for example, if I want to see this guy, I can say, show me the slot, the value at that guy. And so, once again, much like that tilde tilde square brackets command, if you know that this slot has, you know, the information of how many times this program's run or this function's run, you can do that on every single every single thread. So we'll leave it there. That's kind of the quick overview of, you know, intrinsic information in user dump files. I have a piece of paper here with another 20, 30 commands. We'll slowly get through them. What's your advice on how to learn this stuff? Is it one of those things where just practice, practice, practice?
Practice, 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 I think. And, you know, don't forget that the debugger help file documents all this stuff.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for some good bedtime reading right there.
I've found the best way to learn it is to host a show on it. So,
or just watch our shows.
Yeah, and we'll also put this in the show notes, too,
yeah, definitely,
so people
yeah.
can get these, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Well, that's the show for this week. If you have questions or comments, you can leave them in the show notes, or you can write us at defragtools@microsoft.com. See you next week.
See you next week.
Bye.